do 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 do. Welcome to Nothing Never Happens, the Radical Pedagogy Podcast. In this podcast, we welcome Dr. Vincent Wimbush, Dr. Richard Newton, and Dr. Jacqueline Hidalgo of the Institute for Signifying Scriptures. We wanted to talk with these scholars about their important work in transforming the concept of scriptures and its social, cultural, and political uses. The Enlightenment way of studying sacred text, either religious or secular, for example, the U.S. Constitution, as historical artifacts has not included the stories of those disenfranchised by the unethical use of these texts for slavery, patriarchy, and othering of people of color, women, LGBTQ+, the poor, immigrants and refugees, and all on the margins of societal and class power. Vincent, Richard, and Jackie speak about the founding of the Institute for Signifying Scriptures, the turn toward a transdisciplinary approach to teaching and writing about scripture, and world-making in the classroom, the act of bringing the past to the present, and the opportunities such studies provide. Dr. Vincent Wimbush is a scholar of religion and director of the Institute of Signifying Scriptures. Dr. Richard Newton is associate professor and undergraduate director in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Alabama. Dr. Jacqueline Hidalgo is professor of theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego. The next meeting of the Institute for Signifying Scriptures will be held in Atlanta, Georgia, April 11th through 13th, 2024, and is called Marinage, a special meeting in celebration of the 20th anniversary of the Institute for Signifying Scriptures and the 25th anniversary of African Americans and the Bible. The term Marinage from the Maroons of the Caribbean is at root an extricating oneself from slavery. And these scholars show how traditional studies of scripture, with their search for origins, is a colonizing move that betrays a people's history and culture, in the past, but also in the present, in our classrooms with our students. Welcome, Vincent, Richard, and Jackie, to Nothing Never Happens.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. We're really happy to have you. To start out, could you just give us and our listeners an idea of what the Institute for Signifying Scriptures is, and what do you mean by signifying?
Well, is that for me? Should I begin?
It's for anyone. But tell us who you are. Why don't you tell us who you are first?
So that I respond to Vincent Wimbush, and I'm currently the director of the project, the thing that is called the Institute for Signifying Scriptures. It is a small circle of scholars, teachers, otherwise simply thoughtful persons of whatever background or field or discipline, no field or discipline. It represents the opportunity for open-ended discussion. We like to think of it as a high-level kind of running seminar that addresses topics and problems, issues having to do with the way I would put it. Others would perhaps use other terms. The making of the human, social formation. And we use as a kind of critical analytical wedge the term scriptures as a kind of fraught term that is a kind of stand-in for the kinds of operations, the workings, if you will, often overdetermine, but clearly are important in terms of formation, what Foucault talked about as sort of the order of things. So we think it's important always to focus on that kind of problematic. We represent a fairly new, as an organization, a fairly new thing on the block, 20 and 25 years as these things go, big picture. And I'm convinced that scriptures is a troubling, and appropriately, let me say, troubling and disturbing complex category with which to do this kind of work. Otherwise, what's left is a rather large sort of domain of issues that about which we're typically somewhat silent, things that are hidden. So we're going by playing with this category, in my view, to the heart of the matter, as so many other critics in our time and before us have attempted. So I hope that's enough to sort of, you know, get us going, enough to put matters on the table for some give and take.
Richard, do you want to add to that? I know in your approach, you do a lot of transdisciplinary work, as the Institute does.
Right. And I think that for myself has to do with what I found and continue to find quite appealing and appropriately challenging. And that is that the matters that we're discussing, investigating, excavating are matters that can't be dictated by sort of one set of disciplinary criteria, set of methods or conventions. I find that the circle that ISS seems to gather with different partners coming in at various points and contributing in different ways, there is an understanding that we have to look at the way that we arrive with these conventions and customs that often do the work of making things hidden. And so how do we sort of transgress those things as we continue to engage with others and be provoked by not only the things that are being studied, but the way we study them in the first place? What then can come about? What then are we challenged to do, to observe and to ask? And so for my own work, ISS has been a model against which I'm trying to often find my way and be participant and conversant with, asking the question that I have not yet been able to bring myself to ask for one reason or the other. And so it's good to do that in a circle of like-minded folks who agree, if not on anything else, but the importance of raising the questions. And scriptures, sort of as a handle, as a shorthand, provokes no shortage of questions for us to unpack and explore.
Okay. We're going to welcome now Professor Jackie Hidalgo of the University of San Diego, who has been part of the Institute for Signifying Scriptures for some time. So Jackie, would you tell us how you got involved with the Institute for Signifying Scriptures, since you are a New Testament scholar, and what your takeaways from the work of the Institute and their interdisciplinary and creative work is for your classroom pedagogies?
Yeah, so I'll maybe say it a little bit like this. I actually wouldn't be a New Testament scholar if it weren't for the ISS. Like, I don't know that I would have gotten a PhD. I almost certainly wouldn't have gotten a PhD in this field. I was a master's student at Union Theological Seminary in New York in the early 2000s. I was there because of certain questions I had, and I also have always been just language person, so I took Hebrew and Greek for fun because that's what you would do. So that was lucky for me in terms of how the broader field of New Testament worked. That's a conversation for another time, that field. But being at Union in that era, and I got to study with Vincent Wimbush when he was transitioning to Claremont to start the ISS, and just the way that the questions he was asking and the way he was thinking about things, it completely transformed how I thought about just how the world came to be the way it was. And if I was going to say, like, what even drew me into the academy in a lot of ways, it was that fundamental question, like, how did we get in this mess? And is there any way out of this mess? I mean, and it seems even messier now than, in 2001, when I started my master's program, it seemed like plenty of a mess at that point. And I felt like this really gave me something else to grapple with. And so I'll say now a little bit about that. So I've been involved with the ISS since it really started as the ISS at Claremont, but after the African Americans and the Bible Project. Just grappling with that African Americans in the Bible volume, like, that was just a transformative text to look at and a real model to me for thinking deeply, complexly, interdisciplinarily about the relationship between people and texts. And also, I think from a biblical studies perspective, what it did, and the reason I say I could never have been a New Testament scholar without the ISS is I just never was interested in the sort of in purely trying to make my own constructed fantasy of the ancient world for its own sake. And I don't mean to sound really awful about many of our colleagues in the field, but I will say that it just wasn't, like, I never would have been interested in that project or prospect. And the African Americans in the Bible as a project, even though my background is Central American, very pale in context, I don't think that you have to be African American to appreciate the depth of the questions and the concerns, and to understand what's raised in that project is that the stakes of the Bible and the Bible in people's lives are so much bigger than and so much broader than a lot of the questions that biblical studies has tried to contain, control, and confine these texts to. So that would be, I'd say, how I came to it. And then being at the Institute really gave me the opportunity to ask questions in my own research that I think never would have been able to ask, about orientations, about how communities form, reform, fall apart, and how and why they engage with text at all.
Yeah, can I follow up with that?
Absolutely.
First, I've just noticed this, and I hadn't thought about it before, is that Richard was Vincent's student and Lucia was my student. So it's a happy coincidence here. Something to celebrate. Okay. So when you talk about transdisciplinary, can you give some concrete examples of some of those disciplines that have been most revealing or most pushing you to ask those new questions? Because our field, and three of us are here, are in similar field in terms of, well, Vincent and I have had pretty much the same traditional
white male Western Enlightenment European training in the historical critical method, and had to kind of climb our way out of that in different ways. But and Richard, you're in a different generation from us with that. But you know how it's still the art professional society, the Society of Biblical Literature, and the literature that's being published is still overwhelmingly in that traditional category from what I'm seeing. So how do you see ISS and the transdisciplinary approaches? Could you give some concrete things that are happening that are moving, pushing against that, causing, you know, necessary trouble, to quote my former congressman?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, again, scriptures sort of the use of it represents an effort to take the battle to the front lines, to the mouth of, fill in the blank, about what creature we may be facing. So the idea to use that as a site to rethink approaches, but even more importantly, the first set of basic questions. For me and for some other partners and proteges over the years, that basic question is not what is the meaning of that text, text X, Y, or Z, rather in the vein of historian of religion, the comparativist W.C. Smith, from whom I took one course years ago that was very much out of bounds and somewhat saved me, I think. It's the question, what is this thing? Not only the object, we need to even get away from that, but what is this strange, perhaps delusional, potentially pathological phenomenon in which we find ourselves, situation in which we find ourselves, phenomenon around which we are defined, perhaps overdetermined may be the appropriate word. So it's a matter of beginning in a different place. I would also argue in a different sort of problem space, the way some theorists have talked about this, altogether in a different time. Not a kind of happily, unhappily made up ancient Near Eastern or Greco-Roman place and time, which we pretty much make up as a kind of problem space, and then deny where we're actually sort of located in whatever sector or section or domain within any one of several modernities that we may occupy or share. So what we think is important is arrogating to ourselves the right to ask that most basic prior question. Not make the assumption that it is important to ply all of one's wisdom in pursuit of the real or the final, the exhaustive interpretation of this text, fill in the blank, on whatever side of the aisle, or frankly, in whatever complex religious cultural tradition, but rather what is being done? Like, what is this phenomenon? It seems somewhat odd. We know what's required is something like the term I would use, defamiliarization, to the point that you ask the question, why on earth would people live their lives spending so much time investing in this kind of pursuit?
Yeah, and I think the transdisciplinarity of it and the sort of the transgression that often may perhaps characterize the type of inquiry that we're about has to do with the sort of posture that participants take toward the questions and what we can bring to the questions. That is, like Tina, you were describing, the sort of climbing out of. I think we're not a group that says, here is the canon where you learn the rules and learn how to be ruled, but rather, what's the story behind said canon that's been put upon you, and how do you make that the question that needs, or make that the object that needs to be studied? So it's not often even the search for the new question as much as it's often excavating the places of resistance and questions to the imposition of said canons. You know, I think there's a common move made in very sort of theoretical circles to find that new flashy term that helps us name something that we didn't see before. What I often think of also happening in ISS, as much as we try to stay current with anyone who has something to offer on how we look at the human, is also looking at what people have been saying about the human in cross-disciplinary historical terms, geographic terms that may be unfamiliar to us and heretofore not listened to, but need to be taken seriously as well for one reason or the other. So I've here been challenged within this circle, especially by scholars who don't come at, say, the problematics of scriptures from, say, SBL or AAR or religious studies training, but maybe from art criticism, maybe from psychology, maybe from sociology, not because they're doing something special, but rather they're provoking me to raise questions I've often been told not to ask.
Your sort of reflections about kind of what questions do people think can be asked with respect to scripture, what gets defined as scripture and what can't be asked. I think that's a nice transition to this question about pedagogy. I'm curious if y'all might be able to give some concrete examples for us about how scripture, whatever that is, maybe you have an example of a particular like lesson about a New Testament text, or maybe it's some other sort of thing that's been described as scripture. How has that traditionally been taught? And then, so that's the first part. And the second part of the question, which we can get to, is how have you seen those traditional modes be disrupted, and how have you done that in your own teaching? But let's just start with the first part, which is, What's this look like? What's this look like traditionally?
And in terms of, you know, I think, you know, why this matters for how I then take that to teaching is, I think for me, I've always said, I don't think I was told by a biblical scholar when I was making the decision to go to Claremont to work at the ISS that I would never get a job. Because I was doing something too weird that could not be employed in the academy as it is currently constructed. And, you know, I was afraid of that because I need money like most other people who do not come from massive intergenerational wealth. But every job I have had, I think, especially because of what the ISS trained me to do and the ways it trained me to think and the questions it trained me to ask and my ability to bring that to classes, to students, to my research. I'd say that the two tenure track jobs I had, I think I was the compelling candidate precisely because of what I brought in terms of not just trying to get students to grapple with the ancient past and the tools of the historical critical approach to biblical studies, but because I brought to these courses an interest in having students grapple with the deep histories of the Bible and then the deeper problem of what it means to even relate to any sort of text in this way, and what are the range of ways that people have related to them? I mean, part of it is just helping students to understand that, you know, and I think all good humanities classes do this, the world that we live in is not the only world that has been or could be, right? And just helping them to appreciate that we have come we are coming from different places as people in the classroom, and even the things that we take for granted about our world are maybe not the world that the person sitting next to us live in. And the ISS approach, I think, provides students an opportunity to have conversations even about the different world-making practices that they have and they take for granted and that are not shared by someone sitting right next to them in that same classroom.
Yes. And how do you make this happen in a classroom when you've got a diversity of students coming from different faith traditions or no faith traditions, different regions, ethnicities, sexualities?
Yeah, no. And I think that This is a challenge, and I can say more. It's I think even more challenging now in my current context. It took me a long time to figure out and to even I think come to a language for some of what I thought I was trying to do, because I think you have to find a way to build a kind of community of coalition in the classroom. And I now speak really intentionally about this when I start my classes, that we are together as a coalition of learners, and I have a little bit more experience at it, but we are coming together. And a coalition is a mixture of a group of people who maybe share something that they think of as a common cause and a common goal, but they're coming from different places and they're go different places after, and they don't always come for the same reasons. And that's okay. What matters is that we set up ground rules for relating to each other from mutual respect. And that I also try to be really clear that what we are engaging in, and I try to be clear from day one, is we are interested in people, that these are courses that are about people and the things that people do and what people have done, and that there are, and I do not consider these questions or approaches to be at odds with the questions of faith, but that is actually not the center of our course, that the center of our course is what people have done and thinking carefully about the options with what people have done. When, you know, when I taught my scriptures and race class, I think that was a little bit easier because there is a little bit of a kind of clarity of purpose in the title of the course already to some extent. It was an upper level elective course. It was going to draw in a certain kind of student, just I think from its framing. You know, what I viewed, you know, what I view that I take from the ISS that I try to bring in any of my courses is to help students grapple with what we mean by and how scriptures work in kind of, I'd say, at least three levels. And so one of them is to just sort of think really simply, to try to provoke them to think about and appreciate the complexity of the Bible as a human phenomenon, as a diverse phenomenon, as something that humans have made and engaged and that they have made and related to differently. And so that's sort of one layer. A second layer is to then sort of think about the Bible in the different ways and to examine and to sort of see and get their hands on some of the different ways people have related to it so that they can see and sort of grapple with competing approaches and practices. And here I think it's helpful because then I think people start to feel like it's not like I am necessarily always presenting one way to do it, that I'm trying to help them see multiple ways. And then the third level is to get them to engage in what I think are the sort of core questions of the ISS writ large, which are not just about the Bible, but what it means that humans do this, what have been the consequences of engaging in these kinds of relationships with text, and what are other ways we see this in the world outside the Bible and not just in the Bible. In the context of scriptures and race, and in the context of all my classes that deal with the ISS, I early on have students engage in an exercise that's like a, it's a mix of memory and self-inventory, right? But I ask them to engage with their, with a strong memory they have, an association that they have with the Bible. And even if that's that they've only like really ever seen the Bible in this class, so far. But after the first couple of weeks, I invite them to do that and to sit in group in small groups and share personally from those experiences and what they can start to see about what they have in common and what's different with each other. In these sort of relationships. And so I've even done, I do this also in my intro to biblical studies now in my new context, which is the Catholic University context, and it's a core class. And I'll say, I just did this last week, and it was really fun to watch the students because they would sometimes resonate and be like, the Prince of Egypt is the prime way that I thought about the Bible before being in this class. And they would see that connection, or they would be like, I was really shocked to discover that this person, this very different way of reading the Bible, or learning that there are people in the class who have never cracked open a Bible. And I think it's a great opportunity for the students to both feel connections and also start to register their own differences. And it allows them to start to bring themselves in. I do that in all of the classes and I try to encourage students to bring themselves in a way that also starts to open them up to the sense of both their connection with others and their differences with others, and then starts to open up the questions of how those differences came to be.
So I think traditionally, what traditions, which I think is a really important place to start. I think I find students often coming to my classroom with a sense that whether you invoke the term Bible or scriptures or really anything else, they believe there is a mode by which you should operate, that there's a certain way that this investigation is going to go. And there's things outside of the box that we want to address, but we are going to stay in that box, in that circle. And so, for instance, just to think about, the Bible as an example that many of my students here at the University of Alabama want to go to and study and investigate and explore, the issue for them is often, what does this text mean? What is the biblical understanding of X, Y, Z issue? My role in this often is getting them to ask them, why are they even asking that question? And what sort of lurks behind that question. Often presenting examples where the issue is more complicated than they may think. So, for example, the sort of recent example that I've been looking at is we've been taking these kind of provocative Bible publications, instances in the New Testament called Bible zines that one particular American Christian publisher put out in the early 2000s that look like the kinds of magazines geared towards teenagers that you might find in the grocery store aisle, which was a whole move to get students or get people reading the Bible because the Bible was seen as something just too different. And we want to get the Bible in their hands. It was a sort of evangelistic measure here. And my students often look at this as, well, isn't this a strange artifact of this curious group of Christians and their evangelistic mission? And I have to say, and I have to remind them that this isn't all that different from the study Bible that you're getting in your introduction to New Testament class with scholarly notes and arcane lore about how the past was and what this moment was and how if you look this way and that way and cross-reference with this language and that language, that you get to some meaning about how human beings actually are and must be. And that the sort of mystification, even of the scholarly, as they see it, is something that needs to be investigated, Who's this guy, whether it's me in the classroom as an instructor or the cleric that they're investigating or the people they see on the news as seen as you know, some sort of a cult leader or whatever. What are the kind of power plays that are happening around and with texts and what text actually represents that we can explore if we're paying attention, not to the text as thing, but really humans? This is what it's about. It's about human beings and how we work and what we make things do to ourselves and to others. What questions might we ask using an example like these quizzical Bible zines as a way of getting to them, the economics of them, the sociology of them, the psychology and gestures and politics that one brings to that, to where you would say, wow, this book has something to say to me. Well, how does that work exactly? What kind of pathology is that, really? And so getting students curious to ask about how human beings work in one place invites questions, I find, to get them to ask questions elsewhere, too, especially of themselves and what the lessons that they have been taught, the way they've been tutored, which leads, I think, to interesting conversations for themselves, especially with those at home, you know, that no longer should those lessons be taken for granted, but actually we're starting to get a little unruly with the way we've been disciplined and trained, which is kind of the tenor of the conversation at ISS often, is rethinking those disciplines and those canons and those customs and conventions that overdetermine the shape of the human and what humans do and can accomplish.
I wonder if I could, I want briefly, and if I need to be shut down, that's okay, just to speak to what I have learned through the struggle to find a kind of safe space for what ISS represents is that the polity, maybe all of the West, although one can argue that this obtains in slightly different ways in other parts of the world. But the West can be argued to be a scriptural formation. Shorthand is that we're talking about, you know, shades of, again, Foucault, Levi-Strauss, and some others. I would add now Charles Long, a little bit of Henry Louis Gates and the like, Houston Baker, a scriptural formation. And of course, that formation is violent, precisely as discourse. A dramatic example would be that domain, which is in, you know, politics and the legal world, and what the so-called founding fathers, resulted in the United States, did with discourse, right? And text, but discourse, with Thomas Jefferson being a great and troubling example, you know, what you can do with words and discourse. So for me, I would like to think for us, that whole thing is a, as a discursive regime, what I call scripturalization, violent. So to that extent, Alabama doesn't stand out over against Massachusetts. Now, you know, the Alabama's problem may be it hasn't learned how to be as subtle, you know, to hide as much, and so on and so forth. But the point is that we're discovering, using scripture, the problematics of it to think with, that we're all in this sort of box or regime that was put together through violent uses of the discursive. Therefore, the term scripture is quite apt and relevant there. And that's what we need to dig into.
in the scriptures and race class, like I said, it's a little bit easier to then, I think, move to the next step because the students who came there already sort of had a sense of some of the questions that were going to be central to helping us think about that, the sort of histories of power relations, especially in modernity, that have shaped our relationships with the Bible and been shaped by our relationships with the Bible. And so I think, you know, and really at the center of that class, I was asking students to sort of engage in different moments from early modernity to the present, where different kind of relationships with the Bible, as well as a couple of other examples of, I would say, scriptures, not just the Bible, but they've been involved really in shaping key power dynamics around and thinking about the categories of race in the Americas. And so, you know, and by that, I sort of start by having them, you know, think very much about some of the ways the Bible was involved in Spanish colonialism and some of the backdrop for that. And I have them sort of look at a couple of different versions of the story of Atahualpa's encounter with Fray Vicente Valverde, where supposedly he's holding the Bible, and some of Atahualpa's response. But I also say, it's not clear, you know, like when we unpack it in class, it's actually not clear that Valverde was carrying a Bible. He might have been carrying a missal, like a prayer book instead. And, you know, what does that do if we actually start to think about like how the meanings of the Bible here aren't the Bible as the text that we've come to iconically imagine it as, and how even that iconic imagination is part of a historical trajectory. So trying to get them to engage with those concrete moments of the Bible. The other way is, like I said, I also try to get them to engage with texts that have come to be treated as scripture that are not just the Bible. So I have them at a certain point in class, I actually have them engage with thinking about the Constitution as scripture, and both in the context of the United States. And that's both about thinking about it in the past and its sort of its historical formation as intentional scripture, and then looking at how people like Barbara Jordan through Robin Owen's work, you know, looking at how they've engaged the Constitution as scripture. And then, you know, later I invite the students then to look at work around Loving versus Virginia, to see the confluence of these sort of different historical trajectories of treating both the Bible and the Constitution as scripture. And part of what I think is really fruitful about that is, you know, in that class, I would give students a bunch of options for the final project. And I have seen students engage with a broad range of thinking about what things might be scriptures and what kinds of consequences they've had for race and racial formation. And one of the students did something, you know, very early on when I was teaching that class, before I had the luxury, you know, now I would assign, I'd say, certain work from Kim Tallbear or Terrence Keel that would complement this point. But one of the students did a project about thinking about DNA and the genetic code as scripture, and how it's come to be treated as scripture, and why and what the consequences are. And so, you know, I think that's something that was really wonderful about getting to teach scriptures and race, was getting students both to sort of dig into these deep histories of how race has come to be formed in certain ways in relationship to to not only specific relationships with the Bible, but relating to scriptures in a general way, and to see what they do with that notion of scriptures in a more general way.
Yeah, I like that we're putting it, that the extent to which our meetings are really organized as a seminar, that's pedagogical implications, or that's pedagogy in itself at a very high level. But it is a challenge to the way in which this is normally set up, which means the normal setup is, of course, to teach the canon. Maybe some difference, maybe you arrogate to yourself to push the lines as far as possible. But the operation nonetheless remains, if I can use the term, traditional scriptural, insofar as it means finding ways, maybe colorful, dramatic ways these days, you have to work very hard at it now, to render legitimate the world as it's ordered, so that those figures in the past must be made to be the simple forerunners of, as Robinson's Institute indicated, our heritage. We cannot let go of this conversation, this session, without indicating the importance of the example of Black flesh people in the work of theorizing scriptures. Okay,
so lightning round. Because we want to ask you about the conference. We're talking a lot about teaching students to do things, to deconstruct discourse, to think about what is the human and how do we define that and how do humans make meaning together, etc. Give me an assignment that you use to teach those skills.
My goals for the intro to biblical studies now are just much more modest. So in the sense that I do want them to engage with some thinking about this broader category of scriptures, and I do want them to engage with some thinking about how the Bible that we have is not a neat, simple, clear artifact, that there is a long history that has shaped the myriad ways people relate to the Bible. But I actually think of this as having just a much, you know, that course has just a simpler, clearer objective, which is I want them to leave that class, whatever the takeaway is, years from now, it is that they know that there is no such thing as the Bible in a singular sense. Like, that's really just a simple takeaway. That's it. No such thing as the Bible in a singular sense. And so that doesn't mean that I do still engage with what I think of as ISS practices. They're woven throughout. You know, I start early off in the semester actually by having them read from Wimbush's intro to African Americans in the Bible, Brief History, that little fortress book from the early 2000s, and thinking about what it means to talk about the Bible as a language world. What does it mean to think about the role of the Bible in community formation as a way of getting them to think about the Bible not just as an ancient text, and not just the ways that they might have related to it, but the sort of trying to introduce them into the many different ways people relate to the Bible. And then last week, after I had them do the self-inventory exercise on Tuesday, I actually took them to the library, to special collections on Thursday, so they could see different Bibles from the collection as a way of starting to see how even in these sort of ways of treating the Bible as sacred that doesn't look the same, even in something that's the same phenomenon, which is producing this text. So they could see a sort of variety of ways that people have produced and related to the Bible as that kind of text. And so that's part of just getting them into sort of seeing the diversity, you know, the diversity of this thing that they've maybe taken for granted as a singular, depending on the context they come from. And then I've only had them read tiny snippets of the Bible so far in class. We don't start reading in earnest until this week, and we start reading Exodus. And I start with Exodus very intentionally because I want them to see this both as a text that you know, classical biblical scholars think contains among the older oral traditions that came to be encoded in the thing we call the Bible. And it's a great opportunity to think about the tension between oral storytelling and writing, which I think is part of the ISS. But also because Exodus has been such a foundational story in so much of the world around them, and it's a great opportunity, I invite them to play around with the different ways that they have seen Exodus in the world around them as a story. And whether that's very clearly in something like the Prince of Egypt, but I also invite them to think about other options. I give them the option of the film The Matrix, for instance, but I give them other options to you know, and I talk about why I see that, you know, that story. I give them a summary of that story because now most of them have never seen it. And like why I see it, but I try to invite them to see it, and then I give them three very distinct examples of what I consider to be really prominent, you know, what we would say reception histories of Exodus, and I try to get them to play around with those distinctive examples, and those distinctive examples are, you know, the use of the Exodus story in the song Dayenu that's sung at Passover Seders. And I have them watch a video clip of, you know, a guy teaching them to sing Dayenu and what it means. I invite them to also think about and sort of grapple with what parts of Exodus are appearing in that and how. I invite them to then grapple with a different tradition around Exodus, which is to listen to Louis Armstrong's version of Go Down Moses. And like, you know, asking them to, again, play with what are the parts of Exodus that are being emphasized here? What's the sort of role? And then I talk to them about, by looking at the first few folios of the sort of portrayal of the Nahua migration from Aztlan to the Valley of Mexico from the Florentine Codex. And I invite them to look at these first few folios, and I talk to them about how this is not the biblical Exodus, and this is not an indigenous representation of Exodus, but it has been read as if it's an indigenous representation of Exodus. And I invite them to think about the sort of history and the power of colonialism to take a familiar biblical story and map it on to other people's stories and what happens in that context and how there have been different ways from the early Spanish colonial context to the Chicano movement that we have seen indigenous Nahua people try to respond to that relationship and that assumption. And so these are ways that I try to invite them into seeing sort of different relations and trajectories of Exodus. And then I think a lot of the work for a lot of the semester is I try to give them key passages and I try to help them see, I give them different interpretations of those passages and different meditations on how they've been used and their consequences. And I'd say that it doesn't work with all the students, but I felt at the end of this last semester when I saw their finals, and they mostly can take a final exam where I give them a couple of clear essay prompts in advance, or they can do another kind of final project. But I saw that they, in any of those, part of what I want them to do is again engage in some kind of self-reflection about their own contexts or thinking or relationships in some way. But what I saw in a lot of the essays that I was pleased to see was how many of them perceived that, you know, and it came up, one of the essays I remember particularly said, I'd always thought that like, if I just got the right training, I would know exactly how to interpret the Bible. And now I see that that's actually not the case, that there's a lot more that goes on in what people see and understand in these texts. And I feel like that's like You know, in some ways it's a modest goal, but I was really pleased with achieving that goal and seeing that for this student, someone who'd, I think, had come in resistant to the idea that there might be multiple ways of reading the Bible and multiple Bibles, that he kind of left it being like, I can see now that it's actually not so simple that you just get the right training and find the right answers.
I mean, a classic assignment for me was one that I was given and one that I'm still, frankly, working on now, probably more in earnest than I was in graduate school. And that is thinking about the way this language game that we're talking about is discourse that for many scriptures trips them on to examining is a language game with stakes. You know, that's a game with stakes. It's a game with a body count. And how is that the case for the world in which, you know, the student was formed? So, you know, how do you go back and do the excavation of the world in which you were reared and taught and disciplined and learn that there is actually quite a bit of play, as Equiano and so many other examples of whom we could study as these collectives that we've discussed and those who haven't gone discussed the name, like what are the stakes of the play that was involved that led to the world that you kind of came to be taken for granted? So go home, look at the history of the place from which you came, how your people got there, the things you learned and the things you were told not to look at. And how did that bring you to where you are? Because it's like far less accidental than you think and far more scripted than you ever imagined.
Yeah, I think that's a good segue into getting you to say a word about the conference coming up in this April in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mid-April 2024. Will be held here. It'll be a hybrid meeting. We hope that people from all over, indeed, the world, if I may say, from near and far, will join us for a long weekend, an exciting weekend, April 11 through 13. It's the 20th and 25th observances. 20th anniversary of the founding of ISS with a big conference in 2004 in Claremont. The 25th observance is really the convening of the conference I mentioned before, which included people from many different places and disciplines and fields. So a special meeting for us where we will focus on a theme and our special seminar format. The theme is marinage, and not a lot needs to be said about that here except to say it will be an exciting critical discussion. The basic idea going in is to see how in what ways marinage is a kind of different types of responses to scripturalization, to the enslavement that is scripturalization, right? But of course, you can spin marinage in so many ways with so many different historical complexes, but I think that kind of provocative rendering of the theme to be discussed will hold up. And we'll kind of chart the future course of ISS, raise the question whether ISS is itself an example of intellectual or scholarly marinage, and whether that's needed. It's a vehicle of the sort that is ISS is compelling for these times and for times to come. We invite everybody to come and join us, be part of this conversation.
Yeah, thank you for that. Lucia, you want to ask the last question?
This is our standard question, friends. What are you reading, listening to, watching, eating, doing? Am I forgetting? scrolling that you would like to recommend to our vast listening audience?
Return.
So I'm currently watching Ahsoka on Disney Plus, the latest Star Wars series, which I, you know, I've written things on Star Wars and have long sort of followed that mythology. I think it's interesting because it's an interesting display of how I think a lot of people think stories should work, how myths should work. So I'm watching the show as much as I'm watching people's sort of reactions to it, strong and otherwise. I'm also listening to the work of an artist named Anderson .Paak, who is kind of a neo-soul hip-hop artist. Lyrics not for the faint of heart, but his sense of rhythm, his sense of sort of musical history, and his own sort of braggadocious swagger is a lot of fun, and definitely has a good beat, but is also an opportunity for reflection.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know we're running out of time. I would say quickly, I jump around quite a bit these days, so I'm not sure I could name any one kind of secondary, tertiary work. I'm rereading for the major project that I'm working on, you know, the likes of Ralph Ellison and Fanon and Morrison, Sylvia Winter, and the like. Just having to, you know, they won't let me go. So that's sort of where I am these days, again and again, seeing how rich were their thoughts, their engagements of materials and of the worlds around them, and they continue to open things up for me. So I'm playing in their playpen these days.
Yeah, no, I feel like I'm always wary of these questions, right? Because it's like a reminder I never feel cool enough. But when you asked, I did think about something that I actually thought was relevant to ISS, or like that I would apply an ISS reading to. And I not too long ago, I binge watched this Apple TV Plus, the first season of this Apple TV Plus TV series, The Silo. And I think it's based on a series of novels. I've put them in my public library queue so I can listen to them on audiobook when I go running in the future. But The Silo is this sort of dystopian future world where, you know, I think we can only presume it's after, like, you know, a kind of nuclear meltdown or something. But basically, we just enter this society that's a small society. It's like 10,000 people. They all live in this underground bunker, and they don't really remember how they got there. They don't really know what's going on. They just know that they're not supposed to go outside. And every now and then, when someone wants to leave the bunker, they send them outside, and there's like a camera so people can watch how they leave the bunker and then die outside, as a way of keeping people inside this silo and of trying to get them not to question the sort of absence of knowledge that they have. But part of the internal story of the silo is also the group of people who are trying to figure out the past, trying to uncover the texts that were destroyed to keep them from knowing the history of who they are and how they got there. And so I thought that was, there were a lot of interesting dynamics there that are about the kinds of politics of scriptures and world making in a different angle. So.
Okay, I guess it's my turn. Well, music. Lucinda Williams, who had a stroke about a year or two ago, and is new CD, fantastic. I saw her in the midst of the healing of the stroke with Bonnie Raitt in Atlanta about a year ago. Anyway, so strokes went in my family, so it's just been sort of a, you know, it's a great CD. And Rhiannon Giddens, of course, new stuff, always challenging and delightful. And I'm going to go see Ranky Tanky in about 2 weeks down at the Rialto. They're a Gullah Geechee band from South Carolina. And I've been texting Jesus. There's an app. You can text Jesus. Yeah.
Oh. So,
what's the app?
I haven't paid for the premium. I've got the free texting Jesus. It's called Text Jesus.
Well, of course.
Of course. Right.
What else?
What's you in text with Jesus? And then, you know, you can text Jesus, Mary, Joseph, Peter, Matthew, but you have to pay more to Mark, John, Paul, James, Thomas, Judas, anyway.
Wow. Why would you do that when you could text Tina Pippen anytime?
Oh, it's fun to text Jesus. You get kind of standard answers. It's kind of chat GPT answers, but
yeah.
Anyway, so if you want to ask Jesus some questions. And the I just found out the other day that the Holy Land Experience in Orlando closed, and I got to talk to Jesus there. So, well, yeah.
Business.
Okay, Lucia.
Jesus on the podcast.
Well, we text him.
That kind of shows you, you know, they kind of tell a truth about the way it's been set up for centuries.
Renowned biblical studies scholar says Jesus is no better than ChatGPT.
That's right.
That's our name of the
indeed. Podcast.
My next
book. What am I reading, listening to? I am watching a lot of the WNBA. It's the finals. No listener of this podcast is going to be surprised that I'm pumping WNBA on here. Unfortunately, the deserving player of the year candidates were not chosen. Whiteness prevailed in the votes, and that's too bad. Anyway, go Las Vegas Aces.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my pitch. I don't think I have any other things. Oh, well, no, actually, I'm going to say that for a different time.
Okay. Well, Vincent Wimbush, Richard Newton, and Jackie Hidalgo, thank you so much for being on Nothing Never Happens and talking about the Institute for Signifying Scriptures and your creative pedagogies in the classroom. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. This was great.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Nothing Never Happens, the Radical Pedagogy Podcast. I'm Tina Pippen, along with co-host Lucia Holsether. Our audio engineer is Aaliyah Harris, who also provided the outro music for this podcast, entitled Poppy. Our intro music, theme music, is by Lance Eric Hagen, performed by Lance Eric Hagen, along with Aviva and the Flying Penguins. After now almost 7 years of running the Radical Pedagogy Podcast as a mostly self-funded operation, we've decided to open up opportunities for our listeners to support our work. Your donations will help cover the cost for maintaining our website and streaming services, as well as the pay for our amazing audio editors and student interns. Thank you in advance for your encouragement and support as we've taken this journey together. Look for us on patreon.com, and thanks again for listening.